this was a mistake of mine. If I had actually read all of the to-do group's documentations thoroughly, I would have realized that I was doing it wrong and that I shouldn't have hired engineers to begin with and that I should have done it the traditional way. You know, about 3 years later, I started looking around and being like, wait, nobody else does it this way? What do you mean?
You heard my reaction. Like, the fact that you started with that many engineers on the ground I don't think it's normal, but I think it's good.
And cue the music. Is everybody in? All right, cool. Well, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are. Grizz Griswold for Finos. Hope you're doing well. Finally getting caught up on some work and some podcasts after spending a few days in Houston, Texas with my Army friends celebrating my 50th birthday. Much love to my brothers and the whole city of Houston who celebrated my birthday with me, whether they knew it or not. And thank you to my wife for sending me on a surprise trip for my 50th birthday with my friends. And also thank you for it being a return trip. All right, so enough of that. It's time to get back into open source in finance. And I have a really good interview today with Alex Scammon that I did a couple hours ago. He is the head of open source development at G Research. Our chat today took us through his early use of open source when he was a musician. I assume he's still a musician, actually. Learning about free and open source while he was trying to figure out how to just make a website for his band. All the way through to working at Rackspace as the director of software development there. And then in 2019, heading over to G Research. And so I got to learn a lot about G Research as well. I think what's interesting in this interview is there are some insights that I gleaned from talking with Alex about OSPOs, open source program offices, and how sometimes the way that you set one up is not the way that another company might set things up. And it was really interesting to hear his insights on how you should be intrepid when doing something like this and how they did it. So I'm going to let Alex explain all that, of course. But before I get started, I would be remiss not to mention our sponsors for the Open Source and Finance Forum, both for London and New York. We've had some new sponsors join at the leader level for New York, and that is CNCF for the Cloud Native Computing Foundation, and the FinOps Foundation. CNCF serves as a neutral ground for cloud native computing, fostering projects such as Kubernetes and Prometheus to promote the widespread and enduring adoption of cloud native technologies. And FinOps empowers organizations to optimize their utilization of public cloud resources, maximizing the value derived from their investments. Special thanks to our also new OSFF New York contributor sponsors, both Discover and GitLab, who are FinOS members. And, of course, we'd like to also thank our London sponsors, again, leader sponsors FinOps Foundation and Hedera, contributor sponsor GitLab, and our digital sponsor, G Research. So, with that, we're going to actually dive into G Research, Alex Scammon, and his work as head of OS development at G Research. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are. This is Grizz Griswold of Finos. Hope you're doing well. Today in the studio, we have my guest is Alex Scammon. He is the head of open source development at G Research. And Alex, say hi.
Hey, how's it going? Thank you for having me on.
I'm delighted to have you here today, and we're going to go ahead and get straight into it with the question of the day is, who is Alex Scammon, and what do you do?
Thanks. Yeah, good question. I sometimes ask myself that
daily.
Sometimes daily, yeah. But in the context of this conversation, I am somebody who runs a large open source program office for a company named G Research based out of the UK. And we're sort of unique in that we have, as I say, a large open source program office. It's somewhere between 30 and 40 people, wow, if you count the interns and everything nice. Like that.
That's awesome. Yeah.
And it's also unusual in that we are mostly staffed with engineers, and my team is deputized to go and give code philanthropically on behalf of G Research on a range of different projects, everything from, you know, the ML data science tools that we use to do quant research, mm-hmm, to the infrastructure that supports it in Kubernetes and OpenStack and things like that, to even lower level hardware kind of initiatives that are open source. Cool. So we do all sorts of cool and interesting things at the behest of G Research.
Nice. Well, let's go to the past to come to the present and then the future. So let's talk about you. So you're the head of open source development. Mm-hmm. What path did you take? You know, let's go back and talk about, you know, obviously from your background, literally behind you, I can see a keyboard or an organ. I'm not sure which, but so there's probably a story there, is what I'm saying. But let's go back and you know, talk about you know, how you learned about open source. You know, how you came to do what you're doing now. You know, from where you came from.
Sure. I think some of it was based around the music that I did. Yep. Certainly my earliest sort of technical endeavors revolved around building websites for my bands, or yep, having an internet radio station. And to do that, I needed to learn how to install Linux. And so because I was being driven by my musical pursuits, I was also learning about this world of open source stuff, because in music you have to be scrappy and yep, cheap, and yep, there was all of a sudden this burgeoning world of free software that I could, you know, do things with databases, and you know, so that was what drove me to use the tools. Mm-hmm. I think it wasn't until Rackspace, I had a number of jobs where I used open source, but I really wasn't giving back, or it didn't even cross my mind that I could give back to open source, until I got to Rackspace, which was all about building the open cloud. And I was in this office of people who were really into open source, and it all of a sudden became much closer to me. People sitting next to me were contributing directly to open source, and it all of a sudden dawned on me that that could be me too. And so there, I started running a team which did an open source time series database. And it was a really great piece of a great project, but we also learned how to not engage people. we just didn't do that part of it very well.
Okay.
And I learned how difficult it was actually to build community. And so after Rackspace, I ended up, for one reason or another — it's a very long and complicated story, but if you want, it's a fun story. But
we're here.
Yeah, I was actually not working and just visiting my family in London. Mm-hmm. And the guy that I had last worked for at Rackspace, on one of the busiest summer days when everybody is out on the town in London, mm-hmm, walks past me I'm waiting for a friend to show up at a Starbucks, and there's this dude who walks past me, and he has just moved to London to join this crazy company called GResearch, but he's gone out for a walk because he just set off his burglar alarm and can't figure out how to turn it off. And so just by chance, I mean, there's even more ridiculous aspects of the story, but just by chance, very romantically, we re-engage, and he says, "What are you doing?" "I'm not doing anything." And one thing leads to another. There's this opportunity. As GResearch is moving from an old .NET Windows shop to a more open source, tool-friendly place, there's this opportunity for me to come in and help them move from one world to another. Mm-hmm. And so the idea was born.
That's cool. Yeah. Had they already started at this point, or I mean, like, was GResearch already chugging along?
Okay. Yeah, they were a going concern for 10 or 15 years before I joined. But of course they were using open source tools throughout the entire time, but there was a more conscious effort underway to, I think, because the AI and ML world was starting to catch up to what they had built internally, they were starting to become aware that if they didn't join the party and get on that train, that they were going to be left behind. And so they wanted to build this team to help them make that transition.
Cool. So that was what, January 2019, or is that what I'm looking at? It was a few summer, years ago.
Yeah, summer of 2018 is when I ran into Pivo.
Right.
And then, you know, we had a 6-month dalliance where I wrote papers about how we were going to do things, and they had to hem and haw about what were we going to do. And and then we got the green light and started in the beginning of 2019. So yeah, we've been at this for 5 years, I think, now.
Cool. And so they had not had an OSPO before this?
Nope.
Is that correct? Awesome. Yeah. Oh, that's a great way to start.
Yeah.
So you start an OSPO, and you, I'm assuming, is an OSPO one at first, or how do things kind of evolve?
The OSPO, we started with enough budget where I could hire 3, 4, 5 people.
That's pretty stout to start off that.
Yeah, well, I'd made the case that we were going to do actual contributions and engineering work. And I was saying this to other engineers, and so they understood that what this equated to was people, that we were going to have to hire people to make contributions. Mm-hmm. Which is different from a lot of other OSPOs, I realize in retrospect, where we're often trying to make the case that we need to talk about legal or compliance issues and worry about security, supply chain security, and people, you know, on board level kind of levels, they understand that those things are important, but there isn't like a direct equation sometimes in everyone's minds at that level that, like, you're going to actually have to spend money on those. Like, that is engineering work. People need to be hired to do that. You're going to have a budget, real people to do it. And in some sense, I think I was lucky that I didn't start that way. And this was a mistake of mine. If I had actually read all of the to-do group's documentations thoroughly, I would have realized that I was doing it wrong, and that I shouldn't have hired engineers to begin with, and that I should have done it the traditional way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, about 3 years later, I started looking around and being like, wait, nobody else does it this way? What do you mean?
You heard my reaction. Like, the fact that you started with that many engineers on the ground is I don't think it's normal, but I think it's good. And because, you know, I sometimes think that people think OSPOs, you know, start with checklists and then develop policies, and then, you know, but it's that's what I mean. There are a lot of OSPOs of one. You know, even at large organizations, and you know, the fact that you've, you know, started with, you know, three or four and have grown to 30, 40, you know, what, in 5 years or so, that, again, that is, you know, a burgeoning, OSPO for sure. So kudos on that, but yeah, no, I think you're right that, if you don't have the, you know, people power to do it, then you're relying on other pieces of the firm, you know, in order, yep, to get to do the work that actually needs to be done. Maybe is that fair? Well,
absolutely. I think the traditional OSPO model is sort of predicated on the fact that you're at some huge company that has so much resources that if we can just leverage 1%, 2% of that immense amount of resource for open source goodness, that's a huge amount of person power that we can employ.
Mm-hmm.
If you're at Google and you get 1% of however many people, like, that's a lot of
bots.
Yeah, right. And so in that world, it makes sense. But mm-hmm. at a place like G Research, which is less than 1,000 people when I joined, there isn't just that sort of overflowing amount of extra engineering effort. And so I knew that instead of coming in and saying, hey, I want all y'all's extra time to do open source work, we good? Mm-hmm. It wasn't going to work that way. Likewise, they were so security minded and security conscious there when I joined that I knew that I had hurdles getting people from on the inside to be able to contribute as well.
Right.
So I consciously created this entity that was just on the outside perimeter of the entire company so that we could do the work and show the company what it would be like mm-hmm. if they were able to contribute to open source with the goal of over time, you know, changing the hearts and minds, winning people over and changing the culture so right. that the company now is more able to contribute freely.
Do you find now that besides the people that are directly in your OSPO, that you have engineers, non-engineers, whoever it is, in the rest of the company that are also contributing? Like,
yeah. Yeah, no, and there's definitely a larger and larger amount of people who want to be able to contribute. Mm-hmm. We still have some technical challenges sometimes to getting code out the door or being on the inside. The working environment on the inside doesn't allow you to work on the outside as easily as we could. These are still rough edges that we're smoothing out. But no, we have people who from, you know, regular G Research engineering contribute to all sorts of things, Prometheus and OpenStack and I can go down a long list of things. So it's not just my team anymore.
Right.
It is us plus.
Okay. That's great. Cause that is usually the, you know, the mission of the OSPO too, to continue to increase the contribution. And we've never talked before this, so I'm asking questions sometimes off the cuff. You know, do you do any inner source type mm-hmm. work, you know, between teams, I guess, I'm only asking because you said that sometimes it's hard getting, you know, out the door and I know that can be problematic, as many companies have found. And so sometimes they start with inner source for those of you who don't know, I'm just going to say the inner source would be like, it's open source, but inside the company to where there's a lot of, you know, sharing and trading between departments and things like that, as opposed to doing it, you know, outside of the company. So I just wondered if that's something that happens regularly.
Yeah, I think we have a general desire to bring the open source ethos inside G Research to take the sort of best practices of engineering from outside to inside. And in some places, I think it happens more and more. G Research, I think, still has various places where there's lots of tribal knowledge and things aren't done specifically like totally just within comments on issues or whatever. Yeah. But, you know, I think by and large, the engineers that are at GResearch are very good, competent engineers and know that the best practices of the outside world are still the best practices to be doing on the inside. Right. So, you know, having good communication written in tickets, doing good CI and testing and all of those things. It's probably the limiting factor is just the time that people are given to do it versus the engineering efforts they're tasked with doing. So,
right. Yeah. No, that's fair. So, I think in this too, I don't know that we've really talked about what GResearch does. What does GResearch do?
Quantitative research firm that tries to predict the movements in the markets. And so we use fancy AI ML tools to be able to make those predictions. We've got a number of 100 plus quants running around coming up with brilliant ideas about how we can model what's going on in the markets. And then we then provide massive infrastructure to support those clever mathematician quant people doing what they do. And that's essentially the game.
Okay. And so without, I guess, naming clients, like what types of companies, you know, would you say that use GResearch's services, I guess?
Sort of none. It's just for itself, which is useful in the open source world because we don't have to sell a product and we don't have to market. My team gets to come to the table sort of as honestly as possible, where it's like, look, GResearch would like a feature, but we're not trying to sell anything. We're not going to like open source this thing and then switch the licensing on you guys or whatever.
Nobody does that.
No. God, I'm really proud of our open source community and how strictly everyone stays with their license. It's sort of a pleasure because I see a lot of other OSPOs sometimes get mixed up into marketing and, you know, it's good to be able to do that sometimes too. You know, I think that's something that my team can do better at in terms of getting the word out about the projects that we care about.
Yeah.
But at least when we're talking about technical progress that we want to make in a particular project, it's usually coming from an honest place of let's make this thing better. Always coming from a place of we want this thing to become better and we want to be better for the community and we will benefit from this because we are part of the community, but it's not because we're going to take this and sell this over on the side somehow and make some money. Right. We're making money elsewhere. We don't worry about that. We just want this thing to be better so that we can use it better inside.
So let's take what you've learned, you know, over your career with learning about open source and, you know, from kind of FOSS until now, and then running this OSPO. You know, I don't know how well you know the OSPOs and you know work that's being done within the OSPOs in financial services firms, whether it's sell side banks or, you know, now we're seeing a lot of actually buy side firms, you know, involved in open source as well. But I just wonder, you know, like maybe we can talk a little bit about some of the things that you've learned, you know, from early career, but also, you know, in this directly in this role that you think would be useful to other people that are either starting OSPOs,
you know, trying to scale them, and you know, noting that there was always going to be in finance, there's going to be regulatory pressures, you know, but what are some things that you would say, like, if I was doing this again, and I had to do it in a regulatory environment, are there any things that you might have done differently? Or, you know, as you scaled, were there things, you know, that you would suggest to somebody, like, here's something that you should really pay attention to?
Yeah, so the two things that pop up are, even though we're in a regulatory world, don't be so afraid. And the other one is talk about the money. And the first is that I know that there's sensitivity around open source and making contributions and wanting to do it in the right way and having to sign all the agreements. And I, what I see in the financial world is that there's so much that happens before anybody starts actually contributing to the community. It's not even clear that those contributions are wanted or warranted, or like there's just so much not pretense, but precursor steps before you actually get to the point of like doing something meaningful. And I just find that for so much of the contributions that we make, they're totally non-objectionable. They're like making the documentation better or fixing the broken CI or something like that. Nobody's going to come and sue you for these things. Like really, really, like it's not, it's okay. And just trying to help people relax in that world. It's very hard in a financial world. People are very unrelaxed about these kinds of things.
Sure.
And I understand it, but it's how soon, how quickly can you get through those regulatory concerns to get to the point where you can start having the real conversation about whether it's worth contributing or not, like get to the point where you're actually doing a thing first. That's the first thing that comes up. The second thing, I was actually at a Finos conference a couple years ago. It was the one in New York, and I was listening to OSPO after OSPO talk about what they were doing, and a lot of it felt like they were sort of counting contributions or measuring success in ways that were sort of measuring how to sort of put it, like they were measuring activity, but they weren't necessarily connecting it to fiscal value.
Right.
And it was so weird because we're at a conference about fintechs. Like, these are companies who care about finance and money.
Technology in finance, yes.
Yeah. And so I kept on asking every speaker, like, well, you know, how much money do you make? Or have you equated these activities with money? How do you think about this with your finance department? And I was just getting blank looks, and that work hadn't been done. So ever since then, I've been on this kick to tell people to talk about the money.
Right.
And what we've done at G Research, we've recently finished this whole long process with our finance department, with all of the people who in research, about how much money my team makes. And it turns out that if you do all the math about all the developer productivity and all the contributions to top line revenue and all these kinds of things, that my team is easily 2.5x ROI, maybe more like 3 or 4 if we kept on doing the math.
Right.
And that is something, and this is all to do with finance's own models and algorithms that the board has approved. Like, this is, it's not me just saying that we're making all this money. It's finance. Right. And now I have this amazing weapon, if you like. Mm-hmm. If anybody comes at me like, oh, Alex, you're spending so much money on these people, I'm like, yeah, we're making you money. It's right here. And that's the thing that we, particularly in finance OSPOs, we particularly need to be able to talk about the money, because somebody up there cares about money.
This is true. I agree with you. B, it's you know, there's two things. Kind of, I feel, to add to what you just said. One, we find that when we're doing these conferences, that the very interesting thing that happens when, you know, like, we love developers and we love engineers on stage because they're talking about something that they do and they're passionate about. But let me tell you what makes the most impact, honestly, on, let's say, from the keynote stage, is when the business people get on stage and they equate what is happening with what the engineer and the developer is doing and how it affects their business. And and that is something that, that didn't happen, you know, 6-7 years ago when we started this. But when we see that happen, and we saw this in New York this past year, you know, we had business people coming and talking about the value of open source within what they're doing. Huge.
Yeah.
Huge, yeah. As far as the impact that it has on, you know, the C-suite, as far as, like, they start to listen to that, because it's exactly as you're saying, that, you know, this is a great, you know, talk about the money. And then, you know, the example that I consistently use when I'm trying to explain what open source is, and with it, whether it's within finance or not, is, you know, like, banks are paying developers $200,000 a year. All right.
Probably more,
but we go with easy numbers.
And so,
like, I look at it and go, okay, well, as a bank, or any company, I could have 10 engineers and I could spend $2 million to develop this X software, whatever it happens to be, that, you know, should make us money. But if I spend $200,000, open source the project so that I have 9 other companies, you know, preferably banks or vendors, whatever it happens to be, and they are spending $200,000 each on it, then we're still spending $2 million, right?
Yeah.
But the value that my company is getting back, at a minimum, we hope, is, you know, $1,800,000 worth of work that we are not paying for. Plus, we're getting a product that probably should be superior to what we could have built internally, because it does have more eyeballs on it, which is the whole open source thing. But also, it has, somebody said this a couple of years ago when we were doing some research, and they said, well, you're getting the perspective of bank X, and you're getting the perspective of banks Y, and you're getting the perspective of bank Z that you would not have gotten, because each one of them have different case studies of how they use the same, you know, software. You know, so it's going to be inherently better. It's going to be inherently, you know, better cost. And then, you know, and then you add the business value on top of that. Like, if I've saved, you know, $1.8 million, and it's doing what we need it to do, and it's making us money, you know, that's scaled infinitely. So,
yeah, I mean, there are counter arguments to that, of course. Like, bringing in 10 other banks means that the project gets more complex and there's more people to speak with. And if you are on a timeline where you need to get something done, the executive decision is to, we just got to get something done. And, you know, that makes sense. But in the long term, what you're saying, like, is true. You have to put in the work and you have to talk with more people. And if you do that work honestly and come to the table, you know, as honest brokers, then, you know, you should end up at a better place. The other thing is, you don't end up, hopefully, owning the thing forever and ever, which was the piece that was really driving G Research's decision to do more open source, was that, we had seen at Rackspace the problems of keeping an internal fork of OpenStack forever and ever, it just becomes crushingly, overwhelmingly operational. The operational burden is just, it's just too much for that. Though, coming back to the, you were talking about the C-level kind of conversation, where I'd be making the case as well that our team is the sort of internal support structure for open source. C-level people don't even blink sometimes when a company says, well, it's $1 million for support. Support. And they'll pay it just because that's what you do. You buy a piece of hardware and you buy support for it. And invariably the support is, you know, variable. It's okay. It's fine. You get somebody on the phone. They sometimes know. You get to escalate to the next person up and they can help you and you eventually fix your problems. And hey, cool. We're good for the $1 million that you've spent. But sometimes we've had situations where I remember at the beginning of our tenure, we were paying $500,000 to a company who was actively not supporting us and not upgrading the software to the new version of the platform because they just weren't interested in it. But they were interested in, you know, charging us $500,000 for the, it was the only thing out there except for an open source project. And I reached out to the open source owner of that, that project and paid him essentially to add the features that we needed to bring in this open source thing. And, you know, I'm fine paying vendors if they're doing good work and supporting for us, but if they're not, and there's an open source project out there, what we've been able to do is pull that support in house. And this is partly why I've been able to make the case for the large team that I have is that we are the support contract at a much less cost than going out and paying for a lot of these support contracts. And we're providing much better support because we actually sit inside the company and we can attend to the company's needs directly. And nevertheless, we are giving the contributions back upstream so that the world is improving as we support ourselves. So it's cheaper, it's more direct, and we get to feel good about ourselves at the end of the day. So, yeah.
You just, I don't know if they have this in cricket, but in baseball it's called a walk-off. You just hit it out of the park with that one.
I love it. I wonder what the term would be in cricket. I grew up mostly in America. But I sometimes watch cricket and I'm like, I still don't understand the rules.
I did my MBA in Sydney, Australia, and I learned rugby and I learned cricket, and I don't watch cricket as much as I used to, but I got to a point to where I was like, I got it. I understand it all. And I still don't know what a walk-off would be.
Well, thank you. I'll take it. I'll take
Yes. You got the walk-off. You got the walk-off. Perfect. You got the slam dunk. We'll use those terms as well. You know, I'm going to leave it right there.
Perfect.
I'm not going to leave it right there because actually, you know, from this conversation, you hit so many things that like, I feel like I need to go back through the transcript of this and, I will give you attribution for sure. Cause that's what you do in open source. but there's some things in there that I really want to use, you know, for messaging in the future, as far as like, you know, the value of open source in general, you know, that I've been having a lot of aha moments as you've been talking. So I really appreciate that.
Oh, thanks for the chat. It's been fun. Attribute me as much as you like.
Sounds good. So, all right, I'm going to leave it there. Alex Scammon, I forgot your title already. Head of Open Source Development at GE Research. I don't know if you're able to make it for OSFF in London or New York, but I hope you are.
It's possible. My plans are up in the air.
All right.
Yeah.
So if Alex makes it, then I think you should definitely speak to him while he's there.
Certainly people on my team will be at both if I'm unable to make it. Dave or Jonathan, Tabitha, like people will be there.
Awesome. Yeah. Cool. All right. Well, Alex, I really appreciate your time today and the insight as well. And look forward to talking to you again, sir.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
Thank you.